Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today, produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Ben Bernanke gave a speech in New York City today. He did not say he was going to raise interest rates. He did not say how he's going to get the Fed out of the economy. But still, the audience was hanging on his every word. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by SunGard. 1,600 universities and colleges teach and manage 10 million students with software from SunGard Higher Education. More information at sunguard.com. And by Barron's, for more than 80 years providing investors ideas and insights on the markets. Barron's, see what others don't. Barron's.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Monday today, the 16th of November. Good to have you with us. You know, it is not hard for Ben Bernanke to find the limelight. All he has to do is talk, really, and people pay attention. Such was the case today. The Fed chairman gave a lunchtime talk at the Economic Club of New York. Took some questions afterward as well, in which he gave some clues as to our economic future. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports now from New York.
The Fed has two mandates. One is price stability, basically keeping inflation in check. The other is maximum employment. On that issue, Chairman Bernanke said even with a recovery, it'll be a tough road ahead.
A number of factors suggest that employment gains may be modest during the early stages of the expansion.
On the issue of price stability, Bernanke said he's still not too worried about inflation. Former Fed economist Ann Owen, now a professor at Hamilton College, says the chairman's words are part of the Fed's strategy to deal with inflation.
So if Bernanke can convince us that the Fed is going to keep inflation in check, that's actually a big part of the job of actually keeping inflation in check by keeping inflation expectations very moderate.
Yeah, I think one of his major roles throughout this whole crisis has been his composure and reassuring.
That's Dan Cook, senior market analyst at IG Markets in Chicago. He says the most surprising thing about Bernanke's speech was that he specifically acknowledged the weakening dollar. Currency traders reacted immediately, sending the dollar higher against foreign currencies. In a brief Q&A, Bernanke left the comfort of his dual mandate and talked about a problem that hasn't gone away, institutions that are still too big to fail.
We need to have some alternative to bankruptcy or bailout. We need to have another way to close firms that have come to the brink of failure without destroying the rest of the system.
That, of course, is something the powerful Fed chairman doesn't have the power to do, at least not yet. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Great news, fellow GM shareholders. General Motors lost almost $1.2 billion in the first 2.5 months after it got out of bankruptcy this past July. No, not exactly a rip-roaring reversal of fortune, but it was a whole lot better than anybody expected. For comparison's sake, GM lost $6 billion the first 3 months of this year. And in fact, the company is feeling so much better about things that it plans to start repaying the billions it owes American taxpayers next month. Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports from Washington.
Bankruptcy was good for GM. Before entering Chapter 11 in June, the company was staggering under a $95 billion debt. It emerged 6 weeks later with all but $17 billion wiped clean. That $17 billion includes the loan from the government, but Chief Executive Fritz Henderson says it'll be paid back as quickly as possible.
It's a personal commitment. It's a commitment of the entire leadership team of the company to repay the taxpayer, first and foremost.
GM is using income from cars that are selling, including Silverado pickups and Chevy Impalas, to reimburse the government. Some analysts see a risk in the company using its meager assets to pay off a loan that isn't due for another 5 years. But Jim Henry, with the business website BNet.com, says Henderson has learned a valuable PR lesson from the first car CEO to get a government bailout, Chrysler's Lee Iacocca.
Repaying the loans earlier made Iacocca a hero. That's what everybody remembers about Iacocca. They don't remember that Chrysler needed the money in the first place.
In addition to shedding debt, GM got rid of unprofitable brands, dealers, and workers. Henry says GM's decision 2 weeks ago to keep its international brand Opel shows the company is stronger.
Since they're hanging on to Opel and since they're repaying the debt, it seems to me as if now they're starting to look a little bit beyond the end of their noses.
The company is projecting modest sales growth next year. not a recovery, says CEO Henderson, but stabilization. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
In Rome today, the United Nations hosted a summit on food security. Leaders there rejected a plea for $44 billion. It would have helped developing countries that face critical food shortages. A year and a half ago, food prices were at or near record highs. A global recession has cooled commodities like wheat and soybeans for a while. But those prices are rising again, and fast. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has more on one staple that could soon be in very short supply.
The price of rice is expected to nearly double next year. Droughts in India and floods in the Philippines mean two of the world's biggest rice producers are now importing tons of the staple. Alexander Mueller is with the Food and Agriculture Organization, which hosted the food summit.
We know that changing rainfall patterns, increased temperature, more climate variability will have a very, very negative impact on food security.
Mueller says that will mean critical food shortages and political instability in poor countries like Haiti and Egypt. Jeremy Zwinger is the CEO of Rice Trader. He says when the price of one commodity goes haywire, it drives up other commodity prices.
And so you have a rob Peter to pay Paul mentality. The price of sugar is high, so we'll plant more acres and take them away from, you know, rice. Oh, geez, the rice price is high. We'll take some of those acres and put it to wheat.
Zwinger says that volatility is dangerous. When food prices spike, people can't afford it. When prices drop, no one wants to invest in food production.
But what I keep seeing is we go to excessively high price of food to excessively cheap with very little time in between. Economics says if supplies of any commodity tighten, these volatile swings become more and more regular.
To reduce volatility, Alexander Mueller says countries need to start investing in food production now, like working with farmers in developing countries to help them adapt to changing weather patterns and reduce food losses. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
There weren't too many losses on Wall Street. Today we'll have the details when we do the numbers. President Obama landed in China this morning, kicked off 3 days there with a live town hall meeting in Shanghai. The president spoke of promoting U.S. ideals around the world and China's ever larger place in the global economy. The pivot point for that place is the Chinese currency, the yuan, about which there is very little agreement. Marketplace's Scott Tong reports now from Shanghai.
Nong Ho. Good afternoon.
Hello in Shanghainese is how the president began today's town hall. But then the Chinese interpreter drowned him out on the local TV feed. China's voice is getting louder. Yesterday, at the APEC summit in Singapore, Chinese diplomats deleted a phrase from the communique. There had been a veiled criticism of China's weak currency. Gone.
They're feeling like they're in the catbird seat and they don't have to kowtow to anybody.
Consultant James McGregor is former head of the American Chamber of Commerce in Beijing. His book about China is called 1 Billion Customers.
Where it is feeling a lot tougher and a lot more muscular these days. So when Obama comes in here and starts talking to them about currency or Iran or North Korea or anything, China's going to have its own strong answers, and it's not the way it used to be.
How times have changed. The U.S. is now economically soft, and China is growing at 8.9%. In fact, Asian neighbors say China is bullying the region with a currency held artificially cheap. So Chinese exports get a low price advantage. Currency trader Sean Callow.
There is a considerable degree of concern about the lack of movement in the Chinese currency throughout the region.
But if China's eating others' lunch, that lunch is not free. A weak currency makes imports more expensive for Chinese consumers, say California wine or Saudi oil. Eventually, political scientist Dolly Yang at the University of Chicago thinks China will allow the value of its currency to rise.
That will help Chinese consumers to have more purchasing power and also help stimulate domestic consumption.
But China will act when it's ready, not when the outsiders tell it to. In fact, the criticism flew the other way yesterday when China's top bank regulator blasted the weak dollar. Take that, Washington. Pot calling the kettle undervalued. In Shanghai, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
The name name Peter Drucker might not ring a bell with you, but it's a fair bet that the company you work for follows at least some of his rules of organizational behavior. Drucker was the first real management guru, although he did prefer the term social ecologist. He wrote about emerging markets well before they emerged, and he warned of problems in the American auto industry decades ago. This week, management types are marking the 100th anniversary of Peter Drucker's birth. Rosabeth Moss Kanter is one of them. She's a professor at Harvard Business School. She wrote about Peter Drucker in this month's Harvard Business Review. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. My pleasure.
First things first, I suppose, we should say that Peter Drucker really hated the phrase management guru, didn't he?
He didn't love the word guru. It sounded a little like a put down, but he clearly was. He was the first and the best.
He had obviously many, many, many ideas about how companies and organizations ought to run themselves, guiding principles. What were the top two or three that come to your mind right away?
First was the importance of a company having a sense of mission or purpose, and that that's not identical with its strategy. It's not identical with its business model. It's why it exists and what social good or greater good that it's serving. That's a very important Drucker idea. A second is the importance of knowledge workers, that increasingly in the world we live in, people who have information, who work with their heads, are the leading edge of the economy, and those people can't be ordered around. They have to be empowered. So he was a big believer in giving people the power to do their jobs and listening to their voices.
This idea of the company's mission and having to have a clear sense of that, he did not subscribe to the belief that management ought to be thinking of shareholders all the time at all, did he?
He talked about all the responsibilities of management. So shareholders were certainly one for businesses, but also employees, customers, suppliers, and society in general.
What would he have to say, though, about the context that a lot of big businesses find themselves in today of really having to cut their costs and get their share price up and maximize their profitability?
Peter was a very big believer in management by objectives. I mean, you know what your goals are, and then you organize to get those goals met, which means that you do have to operate efficiently, but it also means that you don't sacrifice the long term for the short term. So ever since he started writing about high CEO compensation in the 1980s, he said that companies were often not fair. They often did have resources, but they were concentrated at the top. And that letting the shareholders, but also executives, walk away with the lion's share of the profits rather than reinvesting them, that would not create a productive future for business.
What would he have to say about how to get out of this recession today and the corporate role in the economic recovery?
I think he would have two things to say. First, he would say small business has a big role to play. Entrepreneurs who create new business ideas, and also the nonprofit world has a role to play because they're also big employers. I think he would also say that we have to return to values and purpose and remember what is essential about a company, and that is not whatever its short-term financial performance is, but its responsibilities for the long term. And so he would encourage companies to maintain employment at high levels, even at some small financial sacrifice, because they have to be ready for the future, for when we come out of the recession.
Rosabeth Moss Kanter, she teaches at the Harvard Business School. She writes about Peter Drucker in this month's Harvard Business Review. She's got a new book out, too. It's called Supercorp: How Vanguard Companies Create Innovation, Profits, Growth, and Social Good. Thanks very much for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Coming up, making green from green tech.
You've got very big Danish companies making wind turbines. Germany has a leading position in the solar sector because of very generous subsidies for electricity from solar panels.
Our series, The Climate Race, continues. But first, let's do the numbers. The Fed chairman's hints that interest rates will likely stay low helped lift the Dow 136 points today, 1.3%, 10,406 for the blue chips. The Nasdaq gained by a similar margin, added 29 points, 1.3%, closed at 2197. The S&P 500 climbed 15 points, almost 1.5%, finished at 1109. That's the S&P's first close above the 1,100 mark in better than a year. The highest oil prices in 6 weeks boosted ExxonMobil shares almost 3%. Stock in ConocoPhillips jumped up nearly 2% today. Chevron spurted higher 1.75%. Bond prices slumped. That sent the yield on the 10-year T-note up to 3.33%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term goals. 1-888-VANGUARD. We've got all the business news worth talking about on our new blog. Scott Jagow hosts the Marketplace Scratchpad. You can check in with him throughout the trading day at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases the Producer Price Index for October. The Senate Commerce, Science, and Transportation Committee discusses aggressive sales tactics on the Internet and their impact on American consumers. And the House Education and Labor Committee examines employer-paid sick leave policies and how they can slow the spread of the flu. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Changing healthcare in this country is going to be an expensive proposition, somewhere between $800 billion and more than $1 trillion, according to the Congressional Budget Office. Those costs will eventually trickle down to taxpayers, but there may be some other expenses as well. Drug prices have been going up as the healthcare debate has raged on and before possible government cost controls kick in. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
Drug makers cut a deal with the White House earlier this year. They promised $80 billion in cost reductions over 10 years in exchange for their support of a health care overhaul. But they've also been raising prices. The New York Times reports drug prices have gone up about 9% over the past year. Stephen Findley is a health policy analyst with Consumers Union. He says the price hikes are directly tied to the health care legislation.
It does indicate an industry who's thinking that it's going to have to lower prices in the future, and therefore it'll just jack them up right now.
Drug makers who made billions in profits last year say that's flat wrong. They point to the cost of research and development and rebates they give to distributors. Chris Conover teaches public policy at Duke University. He says maybe drug makers did raise prices to cover the costs of the healthcare overhaul. What's wrong with that?
Drug manufacturers may legitimately be concerned about what's going to happen. There's going to be a lot of pressure on the government to try to rein in the costs of medical care services.
If all this sounds familiar, that's because credit card companies raised their fees in anticipation of a new consumer protection law. Ira Reingold keeps an eye on banks and pharmaceutical companies for the National Association of Consumer Advocates.
They've got their hand caught in the cookie jar. Before the cookie jar closes, they're attempting to milk every last penny out of consumers' pockets.
So, Reingold says, consumers end up paying for the very reforms that are supposed to protect them. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Just in time for the holiday season, the Federal Reserve announced another crackdown on corporate naughtiness today. The Fed says it wants to start regulating gift cards and so prevent companies from charging excessive fees if you don't use them. Those extra fees and service charges became commonplace as banks realized exactly how much money they could make off of them. Commentator Amelia Tiagi points out it hasn't always been this way and it shouldn't be anymore.
Picture this. You're checking out at the local diner when you realize they've charged you an extra $5 for putting ice in your drink. Sounds ridiculous, right? Reputable businesses just don't behave that way. But we've gotten accustomed to being mistreated by one industry, the banks. Once upon a time, banking was a pretty boring business. Banks took deposits, made loans, and people paid them back. Profits were modest but predictable. And then the industry was deregulated, and all bets were off. No longer did banks make their profits from reasonably priced loans to people who were able to pay. Instead, pre-approved credit card offers flooded the mailbox of every man, woman, and child. Opening a checking account became free, while bounced check fees skyrocketed. For most banks, the real profits now come from late fees, balloon payments, default interest rates, and a host of other tricks and traps. In other words, making a profit has become an exercise in misdirection and misinformation. Sneaky has become the norm. A new government agency, like the Consumer Financial Protection Agency, now under consideration, could help level the playing field and force banks to be honest with their customers. Some complain such a move could impinge the free market. But a free market assumes that customers can comparison shop and understand what different products truly cost. But how can an average customer read a 30-page credit card contract and know which issuer is more likely to trigger a default rate of interest? The marketplace for financial services hasn't been free or fair for a long time. There is also some noise that a new protection agency could stifle innovation. But is an over-the-limit fee really an innovation or just a cheap trick designed to fool customers into believing a product costs one price when the majority of customers actually pay far more? If banks behaved like decent and honorable businesses, I would be the first to shout out against a new agency. But as long as they continue to sneak in extra charges and hide what they charge for their services, we need someone to set the market straight.
Amelia Tiagi wrote with her mother, Elizabeth Warren, an article in the Harvard Business Review that popularized the idea of a consumer financial protection agency. We would like to hear from you. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. The big United Nations Conference on Climate Change in Copenhagen next month is still on, but expectations were officially lowered over the weekend. Meeting in Singapore on the sidelines of an Asian economic summit, leaders acknowledged a deal is not going to get done in the Danish capital, but they do hope to have something binding by the end of next year. But all this isn't just about saving the planet. Green technology is already worth trillions of dollars. Solar panels, wind turbines, charging posts for electric cars. So this week in our ongoing series, The Climate Race, we're going to look at how different countries are going after that green business, global deal or no. From London Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports the Europeans believe they have a pretty good approach.
Emily Fursler works for a hedge fund in central London. Her colleagues drive expensive, powerful cars. That's her boss showing off in his turbocharged Aston Martin. But Emily runs a rather more modest vehicle.
A bit of a tight squeeze, I'm afraid. Oops.
The tiny, low-speed, all-electric G-Wiz.
Driving the G-Wiz is quite a strange experience for me because I actually really enjoy driving quite fast sports cars.
You're quite flashy on the quiet, then.
I don't know about on the quiet, even, but the G-Wiz kind of is the absolute polar opposite of that. But at the same time, it's hugely convenient and I love driving around London in it.
Emily bought her electric car only partly because of concern about the environment. Tax breaks and other government concessions were a bigger factor. There's no congestion charge for an electric car, saving $13 a day. There's no annual car tax, which could have cost her $750 a year. Oh, and parking in central London is free.
Without those advantages, I definitely wouldn't have bought a G-Wiz. So, you know, yes, regulatory framework is of paramount importance.
Like most European countries, Britain slaps heavy taxes on fossil fuels like gasoline. That makes the cost of running Emily's electric car even more attractive in comparison. Battery charging at home sets her back only $15 a month. Across Europe, a mixture of subsidies, tax breaks and regulation is creating a new class of green consumer. And, says Mark Nichols of Environmental Finance magazine, a whole lot of new clean tech companies too.
So you've got very big Danish companies making wind turbines. Germany has a leading position in the solar sector because of very generous subsidies for electricity from solar panels. Equally, some of the biggest wind developers are Spanish companies.
Germany is so far ahead that soon its green industries will overtake its car-making and engineering sectors. Britain is not as big a player yet, but a small army of entrepreneurs here is trying to create new industries to serve the green consumer. Take Emily. Like all electric car users, she suffers from range anxiety. Her battery runs down after only 30 miles.
Okay.
Enter Electrobay, a curbside electric charging post.
So I just touch my tag on the side of the post that automatically opens up the front of the electro bay, plug in, and the lights are on. The light is green, and that shows that it's charging. I can go away, leave it now.
London has 100 of these smart charging posts as part of a pilot. Electronic cards activate them. When the service goes live, the cost will be automatically added to the driver's utility bill.
This infrastructure is invaluable. When I first bought my car, there were no electro bay posts or any other type of charging posts available in London, and I could only charge at home.
At the 10K electronics factory near Brighton, Electrobay's boss, Calvi Taylor-Hoare, is stepping up production. That way, he says, he'll be ready when all the big car makers launch mass-market electric vehicles.
They'll start to trickle into the marketplace next year, 2010. By 2011, they're going to start coming into the marketplace in significant numbers. 2012, there'll be very large volumes.
So far, he's built 500 charging posts. Germany, the Netherlands, Sweden, Australia, even Saudi Arabia have bought them. Taylor-Hoare believes his post could become the world standard.
We've been in the marketplace probably longer than anybody else. Next month it will be 3 years. I don't think anybody else can actually say they've had infrastructure in place, working reliably, charging cars anywhere on the planet at the moment.
But as the scramble to carve up the green market gathers pace, even competitors much further ahead, like the Germans, are skittish. They fear competition from a surprising quarter. Last year, Germany was overtaken as the top exporter of renewable technology by another industrial power. It wasn't the US, it was China. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Speaking of which, tomorrow, China's economic approach to going green. You know, we aired the first installment of our series, The Climate Race, at the end of last month. You can check it out on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Supported by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, an observation that deadlines really do make a difference. As I mentioned earlier, there is now no plan for a comprehensive climate change deal coming out of Copenhagen next month, which explains the announcement from Senator John Kerry today. Kerry is a co-sponsor of the climate change bill that is now in the Senate, and he said this afternoon that Democrats will not try to get it passed now until early spring of next year. It's going to be third in line behind health care and some new financial regulations. And that, on this Monday afternoon, is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow gained 136 points. That is 1.3%. The NASDAQ added 29 points, also 1.3%. The S&P 500 bumped up 15 points, almost 1.5% there. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Tomorrow on the Marketplace Morning Report, the latest from the president's trade talks in Beijing. And coming up on this program, the country with the biggest seat at the climate change table.
In China, coal use accounts for 80% of their energy-related CO2 emissions. So without a solution for that, we don't have a solution for climate change.
Our series, The Climate Race, continues. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.